Good afternoon, Your Honors. Ian Hicks, attorney registration number 39332, appearing on behalf of appellant City Mortgage Incorporated, and I have Melissa Sismores of my firm with me at council table. Ian, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal.
I will give you a high sign, Mr. Hicks.
Thank you, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, I'm sure you're familiar with the facts of this case, but basically I wanted to go through just real quickly the basic facts and the timeline because it's important and for context, and then I wanted to go through the reasons why we believe the court's order granting the cross motion for summary judgment should be overturned. Now, as you may be aware, what this case is about is basically an employee of the plaintiffs who embezzled funds and then went and obtained a loan from City Mortgage's predecessor in interest. Now, that employee is Ms. Kerr. She worked at eVision, which did services for the other two defendants. And she embezzled some funds, I believe, between 2006 and 2009. In March of 2009, she went out and obtained a loan from EMC, City's predecessor in interest. There's a $395,000 loan, and $100,000 of that as a down payment went to the sellers of the property, not to City. It's an undisputed fact for purposes of summary judgment and actually a finding of the district court below that at the time the loan was funded, EMC had no knowledge or notice that there was any wrongful conduct affecting the loan or any of the payments. Now, if you fast forward to May of 2010, the plaintiffs learn about Ms. Kerr's misconduct and they get a writ of attachment against the property. Okay, so it's clearly a junior lien at that point in time because a deed of trust was recorded in March of 2009. So you have a simple issue here, lien priority. And then in March of 2011, after Ms. Kerr defaulted, City initiated foreclosure proceedings on their senior lien, as senior lien holders do all the time. And at that hearing, and this is important because it wasn't really clear from the briefing, plaintiff's counsel appeared and made the arguments that are similar to the arguments he made in the district court. And the Rule 120 court rejected those arguments and found that the writ of attachment was merely a junior lien and that City had a senior lien. That's a critical point. A month later, to resolve the default on the loan, City Mortgage, as lenders do all the time under the National Mortgage Settlement, and in trying to settle the dispute that it had with Ms. Kerr regarding the default on the loan, they allowed her to conduct a short sale to resolve the default. City Mortgage only got $410,000 from that. It didn't receive a windfall. The original loan was $395,000. They only got $410,000. And 29 days later, the plaintiffs filed their second amended complaint seeking to add City, and judgment issued on cross motions for summary judgment in September of 2012. Now, the plaintiff's claim in the underlying litigation was seeking to impose a constructive trust or an equitable lien against the property or the proceeds of the property. Those are merely remedies, and so in order to prevail, plaintiff had to show that City was unjustly enriched by virtue of its innocently making a loan.
Well, let me interrupt you here, Mr. Hicks, because your time is pretty limited.
Sure.
And I want you to make sure I give you a chance to respond to what I think, and Mr. Keithley may throw something at me if I misstate his argument. But I think their argument is that you can't, there's no question you're innocent of BFP at the beginning. Their argument, I think, is not a BFP anymore because you didn't foreclose, you did the short sale with full knowledge that they had a writ of attachment. The district court agreed with that argument. I guess, and Mr. Keithley's going to hear this from me, so I guess I'm giving him a heads up. I'm having trouble understanding the distinction, but maybe you do, knowing the facts better than I do.
Mm-hmm.
Could you respond to the argument that your city was not a BFP because it didn't foreclose, but rather went forward with a short sale?
Yeah, I have a little bit of trouble, I'll confess, with that argument as well. The relevant issue with respect to bona fide status is not the knowledge you have. It's the knowledge you have when you make the loan or when you transfer value in exchange for your interest in the property. Not what you know later. If that were the case, BFP status would be extinguished. It would be meaningless. Okay.
But is there a distinction between foreclosing on the deed of trust and, you know, essentially collecting on the promissory note?
Yeah, I would say that the enforceability of a lien is not determined by the manner in which it's enforced. Liens hundreds of times a day all across the country are enforced through settlement. And in fact, they're probably most rarely enforced through foreclosure. So if that were the case, then lien priority, you know, I don't know how you even deal with that issue and manage that issue, determining lien priority, depending on how you resolve the lien.
And would the same argument apply, what you just said, the enforceability of lien is not determined by the manner in which it is enforced? Is, can you, do you make the same point that BFP status is not determined by the manner in which the lien is enforced? And if so, you know, help me with that. Is that right?
No, that's correct.
Okay.
BFP status, I mean, that's the reason why people get, lenders get liens. So they can be in first position, and everybody below that, under the race notice system, is aware of that lien, aware of the rights, the deed of trust is publicly recorded, and they know that they're subject to the contract between the parties, the first position lien holder and the borrower. So everybody knows what's going on. It's that power to resolve it how you want.
So I guess your position is, and I'm not criticizing, I'm just making sure I understand, that it doesn't matter what Citi may have learned down the road, if they were BFP at the beginning, that they're safe as long as they're just executing on their rights.
That is exactly precise.
Okay.
Let me ask you a different side of this. So it sounds to me once a BFP, always a BFP, and the time that's critical was the time they extended the loan.
That's correct.
All right. So I think my, if I'm trying to understand the argument opposing that, is mm-hmm. there's got to be some sort of legal title. And here, because there was a release of the deed of trust and there was no foreclosure on the property, that Citi Mortgage never had legal title and therefore couldn't be a BFP. So can you respond to that distinction?
Yes, and I think if you look at page 26 of our opening brief, the restatement, section 172, that's the restatement first of restitution in the Allen case, was a little bit confusing in the language it used because it mixed in mortgagee with the term purchaser. If you look at illustration number 5 on that, it deals with our precise situation. And illustration number 5, you know, uses the term mortgagee and purchaser to explain that distinction. Also, footnote 6 on page 26 talks about how, you know, the bona fide defense, if you will, not bona fide purchaser, but the broad bona fide defense, applies to, and in fact, not only to absolute transfers, but also to transfers as security, to mortgages, pledges, and legal liens. That's restatement first, section 172. Third restatement agrees with it. It's just some confusing language used in the first restatement, I believe. So if I'll just continue real quick, I think that's the main issue with the bona fide lender doctrine. I think that, you know, so we have 5 reasons. I don't think it's a benefit under the second element of unjust enrichment to get your own money back, but that's not a primary issue. The third issue is critical because the court didn't address it. And that issue is, if we got a benefit, we paid for that benefit, and the court never addressed it. We funded the loan for $395,000. We got our money back. Now, plaintiffs say, and I'll call them plaintiffs because that's what, just for purposes of clarity, that we should have gotten new consideration before we received, there's no new consideration at the time we received the short sale, so therefore we didn't pay for it. Well, that doesn't account for, and it's kind of the pink elephant in the room, that $395,000 that we lent. That went somewhere. We paid for our benefit. And then fourth, it's not unjust for Citi, the innocent lender, or it is unjust for Citi, the innocent lender, to have to bear the consequences of plaintiff's own employees stealing money from them. You know, if you look at all the case law with respect to unjust enrichment, I never found a situation where the plaintiff's own employee, somebody they had an ability to monitor, was the person who actually caused the wrongful conduct. It's usually some random third-party wrongdoer. But here, it's the plaintiffs. They have the ability to know Ms. Kerr, to hire her. They put her in the position of power. They allowed her to be with such responsibility that she could embezzle $1.5 million. That's important. And that's something the court also really did not consider. And if you go to the fifth reason that I believe the district court's order granting their cross motion for summary judgment should be overturned, it's the damages. Now, in unjust enrichment, the measure of damages is the benefit unfairly received. Well, the court granted a partial constructive trust of $104,000. That basically equivalent to, as the court explained it, the down payment to the sellers. Citi never received that money.
But why does that matter, Mr. Hicks? I mean, I think what the court is saying, if I understood it, was essentially the Ms. Kerr stole, you know, all this money, They spent, it was 104 grand of their money that she put as a down payment. Ultimately, that gets to you when you get the proceeds. Isn't that what the court's saying? I mean, you got proceeds of close to 400,000, I think you said. And the court says 104 of that was their money. I mean, it goes to the seller, then ultimately gets sold and sold again. And when they get the proceeds, or your client gets the proceeds, that 104 is part of the proceeds. Pretty much the argument. Why does it have to be the same money?
Well, let's deal with this, and that's, I think, gets back to that. Is it traceable? And that's what it's dealing with. And if you actually look at the case law cited in our opening brief, in pages 26 through 28, it talks about how the bona fide lender defense cuts off any kind of constructive trust that would otherwise exist, even if you can trace
it. That's a different argument. I understand. Yeah. I understand your point. But assume if there was a constructive trust, I guess I'm not following why the court's wrong to say it's on $104,000, which Ms. Kerr, it's their money, Ms. Kerr paid, and ultimately comes back around when you get the proceeds to you.
Well, the city only had to foreclose for the value of its loan. It didn't have to account for the extra $100,000. But I guess you get back to the point that, you know, city was in a position where it merely had a lien. It didn't get the $100,000 payment. And there's an additional benefit to getting cash in hand versus just having a lien. And therefore, there's a distinction that should be drawn there, even though the court, I understand where it's coming from on that issue.
You're at 3 minutes and 28 seconds.
You know, and I will actually go ahead and reserve that.
Thank you. All right, thank you, Mr. Hicks. Mr. Keithley.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Livingston Keithley, registration number 35786, appearing on behalf of the plaintiffs in the underlying trial court matter and the appellees here in this case. As my opposing counsel did, I'll dispense with the facts. It's clear that Your Honors are clear with the facts and the background of the case. What I will highlight, though, as a preface to my argument, is that there are two transactions at issue and being discussed in the court's order, not one. And that's critical to understand in terms of understanding whether or not the trial court below made an incorrect decision of law. The first transaction was the lending transaction in 2009, approximately March or April of 2009, when Ms. Kerr, to purchase the home, stole $104,000 from my clients and combined that with $395,000 they borrowed from City Mortgage's predecessor. That's the first transaction. And in that transaction, the predecessor received a promissory note, also received a deed of trust that was recorded on the property. That was the security interest as a lien upon the property that was purchased with those purchase monies obtained from EMC. The second transaction, and the transaction at issue in the court's decision, was the transaction in April of 2011 when Mr. Kerr sold the property to a third party. It was after this litigation had been filed. It was after the trial court had issued a prejudgment writ of attachment preventing the sale and ordering him not to do exactly what he did. And trying to hold that property because there were competing claims to interests in the property. There was the recorded lien interest of City Mortgage. There was also the interests of my clients based upon the stolen funds used in part to purchase the property.
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Go ahead. Sorry.
Excuse me. Why does that make any difference as to City's BFP status when it made the loan originally?
Your Honor, it makes a difference because there is a BFP status as to the deed of trust that they received, and that was addressed by the Jefferson County District Court in the Rule 120 proceeding, and I'll get to that in 1 second. Mm-hmm. The difference is, for the April 2011 transaction, City did not receive a determination that it was a BFP or not a BFP. It simply received payment from Mr. Kerr. It's important to understand the transaction. Mr. Kerr sold the property. Mr. Kerr received the payment of money from Mr. Vincent when he sold the property, and then he directed those all of the net payment proceeds to pay off the loan to Citi.
So what's the issue with that? I mean, yeah. I'm sorry, Judge. I mean,
I have the same question.
Sure.
I mean, and you said you didn't get a determination there, BFP. You never do. I mean, and my understanding of your argument, and correct me, is if they went ahead and foreclosed, there would be no problem. We wouldn't be here. They would be a BFP. Instead of foreclosing, they exercised a different remedy. And you've said to us that the result is very different because they didn't foreclose. Instead, they did a settlement and got the same proceeds they would have got if they'd gone ahead with a foreclosure sale that they had the right to do because they had an order. And you say that is dispositive of the fact, so now they're not a BFP. And I guess I don't understand where that comes from or what law you're relying on to say that.
Your Honor, the difference is the assumption that their acquiescence to the short sale was their exercise of any remedy or legal right that they had. It was not. The issue here is they were simply a lender. They were a creditor of Mr. Kirk. Granted, they were a secured creditor, whereas my clients were not secured creditors. We were unsecured creditors. The difference here is they simply received payment of monies. Let me give you the hypothetical. If Mr. Kerr had paid us instead of Citi Mortgage, it's unassailable that the remedy Citi could have done is foreclosed upon the property because their deed of trust would have still been on the property. They would not have released it. And the Jefferson County Court had already said that their lien trumped the writ of attachment that my clients had obtained.
But what
so the
court,
lien would have followed the property.
But what the court did is more than that. Jefferson County District Court authorized a sale. So what would have happened is the sale would have happened and they would get the proceeds. Instead of that, Mr. Kerr sold the property and they got the proceeds. What happened is exactly the same. And I don't see what, and maybe what I'm really asking, Mr. Keithley, is what authority are you relying on to say that the mechanism of the remedy gets us a way different result here?
Your Honor, had they foreclosed upon the property, they would not have received any payment of proceeds. They would have received title to the property. Well, and that's the key difference. If they had foreclosed upon the property pursuant to being a BFP under the deed of trust, what they would have gotten is a public trustee's deed, assuming they were the high bidder at the public trustee sale. They could have then sold the property to Mr. Vincent. They could have sold it to a third party. They could have kept it in-house. But they would have received the deed to the property.
So what you're saying is, if I'm understanding, is to for them to maintain BFP status, they had to actually take the deed before they sold.
Correct, Your Honor.
And what law says that?
Your Honor, there really is no case that has dealt with this exact fact pattern. The law, as we've cited in our brief, shows that the deed of trust and what they have, their right to foreclose upon that, is set up so that they can go through with that foreclosure process. It's the same process as if an attorney is paid funds and an attorney receives funds that they know someone else has a claim to. They can't simply give it to whoever they think should have it. They have to hold it and let those rights be adjudicated by the court. And that's what the court's order did here. The court looked at the competing interests, looked at the claims to payment of money. That's all this was payment of money by Mr. Kerr to Citi Mortgage and payment of funds Mr. Kerr received from Mr. Vincent. The holding of the court in the order below was that they were unjustly enriched because $104,000 of those funds were directly traceable to my client's interest. They were the funds stolen from my clients to purchase that property. It's notable that Citi Mortgage in this judgment was not ordered to turn over the entire funds. My client's claims were for $4 million against the Kerrs based on what they had stolen over a three-year period. The judgment was only for $100,000. Citi Mortgage was adjudged to be able to keep 75% of what they were paid because there was no way for the trial court under its determination under stipulated facts to draw that back to my client directly. It simply said, the money I can draw directly is $104,000. I'm going to draw a circle around that. And that was unjustly paid by Mr. Kerr to Citi Mortgage. The issue here is understanding that Citi Mortgage was not part of the transaction. They agreed to Mr. Kerr's sale, but they weren't a party to that transaction. And that's why it's important. Their deed of trust simply sat by the site, and they made their own decision to release it once they received a payment that they believed was adequate enough to release their security interest. They didn't actually exercise the security interest. They didn't foreclose upon the security interest. In terms of whether it is my clients or whether it is city that is competing against established law, I would posit it is actually city that would suggest that BFP status for a deed of trust means that they don't need to go through foreclosure. The entire purpose of being a secured lender is to give you, one, property that you can foreclose upon to protect your loan, and two, to give you an established remedy to enforce that security interest. It's the third step of being a secured lender. You have to have a security agreement. You have to go through the proper financing method by recording it, and then you have to foreclose upon it. What they're suggesting...
But again, Mr. Keithley, you've said this, but you're not telling me any law. What law can you... You said they're going against established law. I don't know what law we're talking about. The definition of BFP in case law doesn't turn on the form of the remedy they choose to exercise. In fact, there's a lot of case law that says a lender can exercise any number of remedies. They could have sued on the promissory note, and if they couldn't collect on that, they could have then foreclosed. And I guess I'm just, I'm struggling because I look myself and I'm just, I couldn't find case law that's supporting the argument you're making, and I'm having trouble tracking with you. So I want you to persuade me, push back.
No, I understand, Your Honor, and I myself looked as well for the case law, hoping there would be some out there, and there's really not. There's not a circumstance here where you have a BFP who is going outside of the established secured remedy and yet gets to retain that secured status through that outside remedy.
So are you arguing, I'm sorry, I'm taking up so much of your time, I'm just trying to understand. Is your argument that BFP, the whole nature of a bona fide purchaser, is tied only to a secured lender in this context? Or can an unsecured lender be a BFP?
Your Honor, the issue of BFP is based in large part upon knowledge of whether there's other claims to the property. The notion of BFP under the facts and circumstances of this case is tied to the deed of trust. The Jefferson County Court in the Rule 120 proceeding did make the determination, adverse to my clients, that at the time they received the deed of trust, there was no knowledge, and therefore they were a BFP and their lien was superior to the plaintiff's for purposes of a foreclosure. But that foreclosure was never actually occurred. It never went to sale, and that decision simply had no effect going forward. In this case, the circumstance here, and Your Honor, I wish I could cite to a law, because I did look and I wanted to be able to say this case or that case does it. Unfortunately, it's a matter of looking at the purposes of being a secured lender, the reasons for recording your security interest, and then the reasons for going through with your secured remedy. The whole purpose of doing that is so that you have an established method to protect yourself against claimants who might come and say, wait, they used stolen money, or I have a way to get in front of you. That's the purpose of being a BFP lender, is to say, if we didn't know about it, we are still superior. The difference here is by not foreclosing upon the deed of trust, Citi exposed itself to a claim that the Kurs had $410,000 of cash. It was up to the Kurs to decide where they wanted to spend that cash. Citi demanded payment of the $410,000. My clients demanded payment of the $410,000. Mr. Kerr, for his own decisions, whatever they might have been, decided he was going to pay Citi and not pay a dime to my clients, notwithstanding demands for $4 million. It is that circumstance where Citi knew that our claims were there, that the trial court decided was constituted unjust enrichment.
So let's say they went forward and sold the property, they foreclosed and then sold the property. At the time they foreclosed, they would clearly have known about your client's rights.
Yes.
When they then sold the property after foreclosure, did they lose their BFP status at that point?
No, Your Honor. Had they foreclosed upon it, they would have gotten clean title to the property independent of my client's claims because they were BFPs. The difference here is they never obtained the title. They never fully consummated their BFP status through the deed of trust. They were simply a creditor demanding payment like any other creditor, whether it be my clients, a credit card, or anyone else. And by doing so, they exposed themselves to the whims of Mr. Kerr's decision-making processes of who he wanted to pay and who he didn't want to pay. And by doing that, they very clearly could have continued the foreclosure. In fact, the foreclosure sale was 6 days away. The cleaner way to do it, and the way that banks normally do this when there is a dispute as to title of the property, is to foreclose upon the sale, specifically because it wipes out these junior creditors and it protects them against this very circumstance. I would say the reason there is no law is because the normal process for banks, which is not what Citi followed here, is to go ahead with the foreclosure so they make sure they get clean title to that property and then can go ahead and sell the property and recover their full amount.
So if I understand what you're saying is if they were to foreclose on the property, they would be the senior creditor and they'd be entitled to the money rather than eVision getting that money.
Once they obtained clean title to the property because they were BFPs when they got their deed of trust on the property and they got that lien on the property, they would not be subject to my client's claims against that property. We would have to continue our claims against Mr. Kerr. But that's not what happened here. What happened here was Mr. Kerr himself sold the property and gave the money to City Mortgage. That's the factual distinction that causes their BFP status. And I'm not suggesting, and I don't want to suggest, that they lost their BFP status or that the court determined they lost their status. That wasn't the determination. The determination was it didn't apply. They didn't foreclose on the deed of trust. They simply took money and payment from Mr. Kerr when, under the circumstances, at least $104,000 of that should have been paid to my client.
Do you contest, Mr. Keefe, just a factual question, do you contest their assertion that there's part of a settlement with Mr. Kerr to let him do that and then they get the proceeds?
Your Honor, in all honesty, I have no knowledge of it. There's nothing in the record, and City Mortgage never gave notice to our clients. I was trial counsel below as well. They never gave notice of the sale. In fact, the second amended complaint that we had filed, we filed without even knowledge that the sale had occurred, or excuse me, the original first amended complaint, we filed without knowledge of that. I see that I'm over time, Your Honor. If there's any other questions, I might answer. Otherwise, I think I've gotten to the meat of the questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Keithley. I personally thank you for your patience with me. If I sounded frustrated, I promise you I was not.
Any questions I can answer, I try.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Hicks?
Your Honor, just to clarify a few points. In pursuit of this tracing theory that is really central to their eliminating bona fide purchaser doctrine, Mr. Keithley said that Mr. Kerr took their stolen money and paid it to Citi. That's not true. Citi got paid off from the purchaser of the property. And I don't know if he had a lender or whatever he had, but it's not that Mr. Kerr took this pot of stolen money and gave it to Citi. It's that the property was sold to resolve the default on the loan, and that's where Citi got the money. So there is no real tracing there, and that theory doesn't really hold water. Secondly, the statement that Citi would have obtained title at the foreclosure sale, usually that's not true. Anybody can buy the property. And quite often, if the property, because they only have to, lenders only have to sell a property for the amount of the default by statute, quite often, if there's equity in the property or a difference between the amount of the loan and it's worth a lot more, foreclosure investors, of which there are many, will go and buy that property. So there's nothing that, the argument that Citi should have obtained title and that that's the only way to preserve its bona fide purchaser status depends upon this assumption that Citi would have obtained title at the foreclosure sale. And there's no guarantee that would have happened. Now, just as, you know, switch gears a little bit, another thing Mr. Keithley talked about is that, you know, we somehow, Citi went behind, you know, the curtains and it colluded with the Mr. Kerr to sell the property. Well, the plaintiffs were on notice after the Rule 120 hearing that they were a junior lien holder, and they could have obtained an injunction or some other relief. We had no duty to them to tell them that we might resolve the default on our own senior lien. Senior lien holders don't act in the interest of junior lien holders. And that's what you have here, a senior lien holder and a junior lien holder. It's pretty simple. And then kind of the last thing I wanted to talk about here, there's really no explanation as to how the element of Citi paid for any benefit received. There has been really, even if we're not a bona fide purchaser, We pay for that benefit. There's been no strong response to that that I've seen in the briefing or an argument. And the consequences here of finding in favor of the plaintiffs and affirming the district court is that lenders will have an absolute disincentive to settle for fear of losing their bona fide purchaser status. That just increases the debt on borrowers because they have to pay the attorney's fees of foreclosure counsel. And in fact, the National Mortgage Settlement, and I understand that's not in the record, but you know, lenders have requirements under federal law to try and review people for loans under the Home Affordable Modification Program, under the National Mortgage Settlement, and other things, and public policy strongly favors that. And then finally, another consequence is, here you have an indisputably innocent lender. Does this mean, if the district court is affirmed, that somehow everybody who receives money in commerce has to try to figure out where that money came from? That's almost an impossible task to accomplish. There's no way for city to know, and it will grind the wheels of commerce to a halt. Thank you for your time, and again, we'd ask that the district court's order be overturned.
Thank you, Mr. Hicks, and thank you again, Mr. Keithley. We appreciate the briefs and the arguments of both counsel. And we thank you to Mrs. Morris. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel, you're excused with the thanks of the court.